This is a download from the Post Keynesian Economics Study Group, PKSG. For more information and terms of use, please visit www.postkeynesian.net.
Well, good evening to you all. I'm Mark Hayes from Cambridge, so I'm using the Cambridge timekeeping system where we start everything 5 minutes late. You're very welcome to this meeting, which is a joint meeting of the Post-Keynesian Economics Study Group, PKSG, and the Political Economy Research Group, PERG, if you can remember all those acronyms. And we're here to talk about post-Keynesian economics, its achievements, limitations, future. But we're going to centre that discussion on this new book by Eckhart Heine and Engelbert Stockhammer, who is sitting here on my left. A Modern Guide to Keynesian Macroeconomics and Economic Policies. And we also have three reviewers, shall I call them? Victoria Chick on my right, who is Emeritus Professor at UCL, this very place. And John Weeks on my left, who is Emeritus Professor at SOAS. And Simon Mohan.
On the extreme right.
On extreme right. That's a little unfair. Who is not an emeritus professor.
Yes, I am.
Oh, are you?
I am, yes.
Oh, emeritus professor at Queen Mary. Very good. The rules of engagement that we've agreed prior to this is that each speaker will speak for about 10 minutes or so, though we have a couple of hours, so I shan't be too brutal in my timekeeping, but with a view to allowing a discussion to take place. So without any further ado, as they say, I'd like to invite Engelbert to begin with a presentation of his new book.
Well, thanks. I'll briefly talk about this wonderful book here that I understand you can buy in the much cheaper paperback version back there from Matthew. I'll tell you a little bit about the book and a little bit on where I think that post-Keynesian economics is right now and what its major challenges are. Now, the book is called A Modern Guide to Keynesian Macroeconomics and Economic Policies, but it's really meant as a postgraduate level introduction slash survey of the state of art of post-Keynesian economics. Its background, I'll talk in a few minutes why I equate Keynesian economics and post-Keynesian economics. Its specific background is the summer school of the research network Macroeconomics and Macroeconomic Policies. We've had three rounds of the summer school, and we intend to have the summer schools on a regular basis every other year. And the contributions in the book are, I think, with one exception, are all out of the basically all lectures from the summer school. The motivation, the summer school is a quite intense 1 week event taking place in Berlin. It's kind of a post-Keynesian boot camp. And the motivation for the summer school was that, at the very least in continental Europe, but I think we can extend that to non-continental Europe, there's really no postgraduate level program that would give students a solid foundation in post-Keynesian economics. And what the summer school was designed for was to give support and the background to students who want to work in the area of post-Keynesian economics, but who are not able to get the appropriate graduate level courses at their university. So that also explains why some of the chapters in the book are a little bit technical, because it's essentially intended as a reader for a postgraduate level course. So the book covers the history and methodology of post-Keynesian economics by Marc Lavoie, Money, Credit, Central Banks. It has several chapters that deal with basic macroeconomic models on growth by Amitabh Datt. It has two or three chapters that deal with more short, medium-run issues, models of effective demand, income distribution, unemployment, and inflation. It has two chapters, one more theoretical, one more applied, on unemployment, one by myself, one by David Howell from the New School. It has two chapters on open economy, macroeconomics, and the issue of globalization. And it has two chapters on financialization and financial crisis. The design of the book was, and the summer school started before 2008. Afterwards, we probably would have had the financial crisis even more prominently. Now, overall, the book is, if you're familiar with the debates around post-Keynesian economics, is probably having more of a Kaletskian twist within within post-Keynesian economics. But it does have as most of the Kaletskian tradition, it does have a broad tent approach to post-Keynesian economics. So it does give prominence to the concept of fundamental uncertainty. Briefly, what do I consider as the main building blocks of post-Keynesian economics? I'll would highlight that under the headings of effective demand, fundamental uncertainty, the relevance of income distribution, and the specific role of money and financial instability. The principle of effective demand essentially says that the causality runs in macroeconomics runs from investment to savings, and that it's income that equilibrates the two, which if you have a background in macroeconomics, is quite different what you learn in most modern macroeconomic textbooks. The concept of fundamental uncertainty means that people live in a world that is not completely determined as regards the future. Therefore, individuals are not in any position to make reasonably rational forecasts and expectations about the future, except maybe a fairly short run. That means that rational behavior in a strong neoclassical sense is not feasible. The issue, unlike what Robert Shiller and George Akerlof would tell you in their book that is somewhat misleadingly called Animal Spirits, it's not about people being irrational, but the world not being sufficiently determinate for people to be rational. So it's about non-rational, not about irrational behavior. For post-Keynesian economists, the conclusion of the existence of fundamental uncertainty is that social norms, conventions, institutions play an important role. The concept of fundamental uncertainty is particularly important for the theory of money because it explains why people hold money, basically as an insurance against uncertainty, and it's particularly important in the determination of investment expenditure because all long-term decisions, and investment expenditures being the primary among them, will be made under conditions of uncertainty and therefore cannot be fully rational but have a strong social convention element in them. Income distribution, or more broadly speaking, social conflict, is prominent in post-Keynesian economics, in particular in the Kaletskian variant of it. There's two central arguments why income distribution is so important. The first is different savings propensities between recipients of wage income and of capital income. That is a core, that's sometimes called the Caldorian or Cambridge savings equation, but is a core building block of various kind of heterodox macroeconomics in the meantime. Closely connected to that, there's the issue of investment expenditures. And these types of post-Keynesian macro models recognize that investment expenditures are done by capitalists or by firms, not by workers, which again is quite different from in neoclassical growth models where the savings decision essentially determines investment expenditures and that is done by households. The second big area where conflict, social conflict, is important is about the theory of inflation. That might not be shared by all post-Keynesians equally, but there's a broad stream within post-Keynesian economics that had what is called a conflicting claims approach to the theory of inflation and says essentially that inflation is the result of unresolved distributional conflicts and they first show up in the monetary sphere in terms of wage-price spirals, and might or might not in the long term be resolved by unemployment. Fourth, because of the existence of fundamental uncertainty, there's a unique role for money in post-Keynesian theory. Money is held because, to some extent, because people and financial investors don't know what the future will bring, and the more they're worried about uncertainty of the future, the more willing they will be to hold money. But there's more to monetary theory of post-Keynesians. One important theory or contribution of post-Keynesian economics in the field of monetary economics is the theory of the endogenous money supply. It's essentially banks that are creating money and not the central bank. The causality is running from credit to deposits, and deposits essentially money. In a modern economy, what we call money is essentially the short-term liabilities of the banking sector. The second big contribution of post-Keynesian economics in the field of monetary economics is a theory of financial instability, and in the case of Hyman Minsky, a theory of endogenous financial instability in the book that's covered by Gary Dimsky. Hyman Minsky developed further a theory that you might regard in Keynes, but you might also as not quite yet in Keynes, arguing that in the course of an economic expansion, there's endogenous shift in what the financial sector and what firms regard as acceptable levels of risk. And that acceptable level of risk is expressed in an acceptable level of debt relative to income. Thus, there's endogenous shift in what is regarded as an acceptable leverage ratio. And so Minsky tells a story that in a boom phase where investors have bad memories of the last crash, they start investing prudently, and in the course of the emerging asset price boom, they get more and more open to taking higher risks. Higher risk means that they are taking on taking out more loans, taking on higher rates of leverage, which in the early phases, of course, feeds the bubble. There will be some point where the higher leverage ratios will be unsustainable. Now, these are the core building blocks of post-Keynesian economics. Admittedly, the last building block, Minsky theory, is not always sufficiently integrated in post-Keynesian models. So where is post-Keynesian economics right now? In my view, post-Keynesian economics is conceptually consolidated. We have a fair number of academic journals that publish post-Keynesian economics. Maybe more importantly, there's textbooks out there, and there's a broad agreement on the part of most post-Keynesians what post-Keynesian economics is about. I'm emphasizing that because that's not necessarily the case for other heterodox traditions. I would think that, say, for Marxian economics or for institutional economics, you don't have comparable textbooks that most people or most people working within that tradition would agree on. There's also well-established conferences in the area of post-Keynesian economics, and in many countries, we have well-functioning post-Keynesian economics associations. I'm afraid to admit that in Great Britain, the post-Keynesian study group is one of the weaker ones compared to, say, the French or the German association or the Brazilian ones, and I hope that we'll be able to catch up with them in the foreseeable future. At the same time, of course, post-Keynesian economics is institutionally marginalized, and that experience it shares very much with basically all other traditions of heterodox economics. Modern journal rankings in Great Britain the research assessment exercise, or the new euphemism, the research excellence framework, is contributing to that marginalizations. As the major achievements of post-Keynesian economics, I would regard that it has an established short-term, medium-term macro model, in particular theory of the endogenous money supply or the money generation process, its contributions to the rejection of the need of micro-foundations based on rational behavior, but and its insistence on the need for a genuine macroeconomics, its theory of financial instability is what I would consider its major achievements. Recently, I would also highlight that post-Keynesian economists have generated quite a bit of applied research. So post-Keynesian economics does have the theoretical foundation, but it's also increasingly generating empirical research. And there is also an increasing amount of policy-oriented literature, which I think is quite a change from if you look at the scene of, say, the 1970s, when there were some outstanding personalities like Nick Calder who were in the area of policy advice, but overall it's probably fair to say that most of post-Keynesian economics was fairly abstract. That said, there's also weaknesses of post-Keynesian economics. I want to mention three of them. The first is that the supply-side analysis of post-Keynesian economics is still underdeveloped. There's increasing interest in the tradition of Niklas Kaldor, recently by papers by Amit Havadutta and by Amit Baduri, of endogenizing supply-side aspects, but overall it's fair to say that we don't have a whole lot to say on it. Second, there's the whole big issue of ecological limits to the growth process that post-Keynesian economics has so far embarrassing little to say on. We have in the conference that I'm part of, the organizing committee, the Berlin conference of the research network macroeconomics, we have tried to introduce that topic, but it's proving very difficult because there's disappointingly little to connect on the ecological economic side as well as on the post-Keynesian side. The third area that I would like to highlight is that post-Keynesian economics, for most of its analysis, is really economics and macroeconomics. There's disappointingly little on the political economy of the state. Most of what we say about the state is fairly normative, is about what the state should be doing. There's very little analysis of what states are actually doing and how the different social groups or classes that we do to some extent recognize in our economic analysis, how they try to influence the state. With all these areas, I would argue that it would be good for post-Keynesian economics to interact with other heterodox traditions. Finally, what do I regard as the key challenges for post-Keynesian economics? I want to briefly discuss that in the remaining 4 minutes, I guess, under the headings institutional challenges, theoretical or conceptual challenges, and economic policy challenges. Now, the institutional challenges are relatively clear. There's an enormous pressure within economics against all kinds of heterodox positions, and post-Keynesian economics is suffering from that, as I would argue all other heterodox traditions are suffering. That is expressed in Britain in the RAE, in the Research Excellence Framework. That is expressed in various countries in journal rankings that effectively make it very hard for junior researchers to get university jobs. In Great Britain, even more than in other countries, that has led to an exodus of critical or heterodox economists out of the field of economics and trying to find their niches in various other social disciplines, which, of course, is a rational survival strategy, but it's not good for the field of economics, and it certainly poses a challenge to us. It is also the case that often, institutionally, we don't have, as post-Keynesians, have a whole lot to offer to non-economists. Our discourse usually is fairly economic-centered. Theoretically, I think that post-Keynesian economics is in pretty good shape, that doesn't mean that there aren't challenges. The first is that new Keynesian economics, or bastard Keynesians, as they were called a few decades ago, are reinventing various post-Keynesian wheels, usually without giving any reference to the post-Keynesians who did the same work much earlier. You have that in the field of the endogenous money supply that is standard in new consensus macroeconomics now, without them having much of a theory of the banking sector. You can witness it very clearly in how financial stability is discussed these days, where even in IMF reports you now have regularly references to Hyman Minsky, but no reference whatsoever to the people who have worked in the tradition of Hyman Minsky afterwards. It is also the case that elements of the Nairu theory have long-standing post-Keynesian predecessors that are also not recognized. We could go on with that list, but I think it makes the point very clearly. The second major conceptual challenge is that within mainstream economics there have been quite important changes. The area of macroeconomics within the mainstream is fairly fossilized. We still have in the academic journals real business cycle theories, representative agent, rational expectation models, not so much in applied research, but if you look at the American Economic Review, if you don't believe me, it's still out there and it speaks. So mainstream economics in the area of macro is fairly conventional. However, in microeconomics, there's all kinds of interesting developments. There's agent-based modeling, there's evolutionary economics, there's behavioral economics. All that is taking place without being aware and without making any reference to post-Keynesian economics, and there's next to no interaction between post-Keynesian economics and those more innovative streams within the mainstream. Now, in terms of economic policy, I think for a further development of post-Keynesian economics, it's essential that we are relevant, that we have things to say about actual and problematic economic developments. Of course, one of the major developments in the last years is financial instability and the return of the crisis. In terms of economic policy, what Colin Crouch labeled privatized Keynesianism is a challenge to us. By privatized Keynesianism, Colin Crouch means a very selective and class-biased economic activism, most directly illustrated by the bank rescue packages that are aimed at stabilizing the financial sector without dealing with issues of unemployment. That, of course, we don't have much of an analysis of this phenomenon of privatized Keynesianism because we don't have much of an analysis of the state. And, of course, it takes over the name of Keynesianism. Now, in the U.S., we have a situation where there's several prominent mainstream post-Keynesians that are politically progressive, like Joseph Stiglitz or Paul Krugman. In Europe, we actually don't have that competition. The Keynesian field is basically left open all the way to us. In the area of applied economics, if you look at OECD reports and IMF reports, you find quite a revival of bastard Keynesianism. You find studies on what the multiplier is. You find serious discussions of financial instability. You don't see that in academic economics or macroeconomics. And in that situation, it's important for us to intervene. Ultimately, I think whether post-Keynesian economics will be able to go to a renaissance will depend very crucially on whether we have something to offer in terms of economic analysis and policy advice to social movements that will react to the pressures that emerge out of the present crisis.
Thank you very much, Engelbert. Well, that was quite a long 10 minutes. Thank you very much. It was very ambitious, I think, to try and get across the content of this book in 10 minutes, so you were defeated by that. But thank you very much. And if I may now, I'll move on to Victoria Chick, who will give her response.
Well, I was asked to be one of the reviewers of this book, and I took on the task very enthusiastically. Engelbert has already indicated the scope of the essays it contains, 13 essays. And the first thing to say is that I think they're of uniformly high quality, and the way they handle the scope of their discussion and the range of the literature that's encompassed by those discussions is exemplary. I'm particularly interested in the emphasis on distribution, income distribution, because normally this is rather an underdeveloped area in the Keynesian and post-Keynesian camp. In this book, income distribution is linked to a theme that recurs and which this group of scholars takes for granted, and that is the notion of wage-led and profit-led economies. There are several allusions to this contrast throughout the volume, and yet there's no, I think, really clear statement of what it means and the criteria used to define these two states of being. I think this contrast is stimulating and interesting and rather underexplained, and I wished there had been a chapter devoted to it, because I think it's a very important idea. The essays that do deal with distribution deal with functional distribution, wage-related and profit, wage-led and profit-led, and so on. Functional distribution, and this is in contrast to aspect of distribution which is exercising the Occupy movement and a lot of blogs, which is the size distribution of personal incomes, which, as you know, is extremely skew and getting worse all the time. And I would have liked to have known whether any of the authors had anything to say about how on earth this has been engineered by the 1% against the 99. but that's just saying that, you know, there was room for a 14th chapter, a 15th chapter, to suggest things which aren't in the book, rather than reviewing things that are. There are three chapters which are concerned with the influence of institutions on outcomes, and that again is a feature I find very welcome, because I've always made the point that theory is contingent on institutions, and the behavior of economies is channeled through institutions, and their structure models that behavior. Of the four chapters that are concerned one way or another with finance, only one of them deals with the crisis in a head-on sort of way, the last article by Dimsky, but Engelbert has explained what I found puzzling. I hadn't realized that the genesis of the book went as far back as it did. I thought, well, you know, published in 2011, probably the instructions went out in 2009. The crisis had been going on for some time, but actually, no, they started a lot earlier, and that explains why the crisis gets such short shrift. The brief to give an overview of subjects rather than to provide novel material is again explained both by the title of the book, it is a guide, and by Engelbert's further remarks. But there are some contributions, some new ideas, at least they're new to me as well. And in addition to overview papers, there are two absolutely searing critiques by Philip Orestius, one of the New Consensus and the other of EU policy. And in addition to what I've already outlined, there is at the beginning what you might call an overview of overviews by Marc Lavoie, who summarizes both a very short and, by necessity, rather skew-if theory, account of the history of post-Keynesian economics, and I think more importantly, from the point of view of the structure of the book, the key methodological principles on which post-Keynesian economics is based. I think it's a stunning chapter, and it does have a little original twist, which I like very much indeed. In a little table, he indicates that post-Keynesian economics is full of paradoxes, but instead of the two or three that we all know, we have the paradox of thrift, we know that one, the paradox of costs, that higher real wages lead to higher profit rates, the paradox of public deficits, that government deficits raise private profits, the paradox of debt, efforts to deleverage might lead to higher leverage ratios, the paradox of tranquility, stability is destabilizing, the paradox of liquidity, new ways to create liquidity end up transforming liquid assets into less liquid ones, and the paradox of risk, the availability of individual risk cover leads to more risk overall. I think that's a very neat little original twist. In the book, and something I would certainly use if I were still teaching to indicate the strangeness that comes out of the fallacy of composition, because that is, of course, the essential concept for macroeconomics and the one that mainstream economists find extremely difficult to grasp, poor souls. Again, Engelbert's essay on, he titles it Unemployment, but it's really just as much about employment, also has some new twists, one of which I want to discuss with him before I go public on it. But the second one, the article falls into two parts, really, is encouraging us to learn to love the Nairu, something that most post-Keynesians have an instinctive reaction against. But he says that this instinctive reaction is to the Nairu story, that is to say, what mainstream economists have made of the Nairu, namely, they interpret it as a labor market, in a labor market rigidity framework, but that if we discount that and look at Nairu theory, it is compatible with post-Keynesian economics. I need to do a little bit more work there before I'm convinced, but I like being provoked. But for me, the basic question, and I think you said you were going to touch on this, but I don't think you did, or if you did, I missed it, and I was paying attention, is why Keynesian in the title? Huh? A Modern Guide to Keynesian Macroeconomics and Economic Policies. And throughout the book, I find that Keynesian and post-Keynesian are often used interchangeably. And the name of Keynes, supposedly the inspiration for post-Keynesian economics, rarely appears. You know, why is this? What is going on here? And how is a student to interpret this? I would like to know what was in the authors' and editors' minds, and since we have one, I'm likely to find out, where they think the borders and the areas of overlap between Keynesian and post-Keynesian and Keynes's economics lie. It's not at all clear from the book. And the comparison of this collection in the editor's preface to the Holt and Pressman handbook further dismayed me, because that handbook thoroughly conflated Keynesian and post-Keynesian economics. So it raises a good deal of anxiety. And this is particularly puzzling in the light of the very clear statement of, in Lavoie's overview of overviews of the methodological principles on which post-Keynesian economics is based, which Keynesian economics does not share. Now, what is the methodological foundation in which one can treat Keynesian and post-Keynesian more or less interchangeably? This, to me, is the big puzzle of the book. Only once is this conundrum tackled head-on, and this is halfway through the last essay in the volume, Dimsky's essay. on page 330, we've been puzzled all this time, and then, no, but he doesn't solve the puzzle, he simply raises the point. He writes, "For Keynesians, bracket, or post-Keynesians, end bracket," what? "identifying sources of crisis and breakdown in financial processes involves building bridges from Keynes's own insights to contemporary economic dynamics." He goes on to explain what bridges have been built and why they are bridges and what they say about the crisis. And this, to me, is absolutely the right approach. One doesn't want to do a post-Keynesian economics that goes back to Keynes and says, nothing that's happened since can be a contribution. We must, you know, hold fast to daddy's coattails, because the world has moved on. And you can't ignore that fact if you think institutions shape behavior, as I've just said. So I mean, when the world moves on and institutions change, you have to build a bridge from your initial inspiration to take account of those changes. And Dimsky shows what has been done in that respect in the financial sphere. This seems to me to be the right way to look at post-Keynesian economics. And I think it, if it had been applied in the other fields that are surveyed here, the result might have been less confusing and less anxiety-creating for people like me who think that methodological foundations are the thing that divides schools of economic thought. Perhaps this distinction was smoothed over out of a desire not to cause a fuss. Post-Keynesians often try to avoid bringing out disputes amongst heterodox schools. We are an embattled lot, and any friend, you know, is worth having, perhaps. But I think, faced with the methodological differences which post-Keynesians have gone to a lot of effort to expose, it might be time to start bringing out those differences or making those differences clear. Mark Lavoie is clearly talking about post-Keynesian economics, not Keynesianism. It's absolutely, absolutely clear. Dimsky is talking about post-Keynesianism. That is absolutely clear, despite his brackets. These are the end pieces, the bookends of the volume. In between, it's not so clear at all. And that, to me, is the only worrying aspect of the book. As I said at the beginning, I think the essays are of the highest quality, and they give a very substantial account of a strand of current heterodox thought. The only other point that I would like to raise is that most of the essays attempt to differentiate the product on the Keynesian, post-Keynesian side from mainstream economics and in particular the new consensus. So one is left with that dichotomy. Now, for a student, this is wonderful because it's a pluralist approach. You get two sides of that approach. I think every generation has to fight its way out of what they were taught. And this generation was very much influenced by the new consensus, and it is reflected in the volume. However, this dichotomy doesn't really resolve the question of the distinctions that go on the Keynesian side, which I wish had been clearer. I meant to end on a positive note. I'm afraid I didn't manage that because I mismanaged my organization a little bit, but I am extremely positive about the book.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Vicky. Good. Well, I think perhaps I could ask John Weeks to...
Yes, and I will make every effort to stick to my 10 minutes. First, thank you for inviting me to do this. I'm very honored because I think this is an excellent collection of essays. I don't agree with everything in it, but I think it is very well done. And I want to begin by my comments by referring to two recent things I read in the newspaper. On Friday in The Guardian, Philip Inman wrote that the Italian crisis is occurring because Italian workers have paid themselves more than their German equivalents over the last 10 years for doing less work, less productively. Which is, I was under the impression that employers paid workers, but evidently in Italy the workers paid themselves. So that's the cause of the Italian crisis. And we're told in the New York Times today that in both Italy and Greece, it is not only the economy that is on trial, but also the ability of democratic governments to make highly unpopular choices. What has the world come to that we read such vulgar crap in respectable newspapers? It is because the economics profession has degenerated into what Krugman has called about a month ago that the barbarians have taken over the temple. And that, I think, is exactly what happens. I would agree with Vicky's comment that about title might be changed, perhaps in a different way. Leave out Keynesian. This is macroeconomics. There is no macroeconomics that's not Keynesian. There's no gravity without, Newton. Right? So would you talk about the Newtonian theory of gravity? The economics profession, what is taught to students, is akin to alchemy and astrology. And in fact, I'm writing a book called Alchemics. And who are the leading economists of our generation? They're here. This is where they are. This is where the economists are. The other people do a version of alchemy. And I would say the essential characteristic, what differentiates us from them, is demand constrained versus price constrained. That is, the people who call themselves the leading economists live in a price constrained world. In a price constrained world, you have full employment. You can't be price constrained otherwise. So all the parables about relative prices are based on a fantasy of full employment. The great thing about this book is there are no relative price stories here. This is a book about a demand-constrained world. And I would lead that into... I've actually written a review which will be published, so I won't go into that. Feel free to... if you want, I can send you a copy of it. It'll be coming out in the Review of Radical Political Economics. And I would just like to, I don't want to create different distinctions because, as Vicky said, we know that we need every friend that we can get. I remember being shocked at a conference in Denmark I went along to, and Mark Lavoie spoke. And in answer to a question, he said that he no longer taught monetary economics because the people in this in Canada, I thought Canada was a liberal place, this, that they no longer allowed him to do it because he wasn't within the mainstream. Not only have the barbarians taken over the temple, they have, like, they've instituted an inquisition, which is similar, if not quite with the same type of physical pain, that the of the Inquisition in Spain, which sought to get rid of the Arabs and the Jews. Well, the post-Keynesians, Marxists and so on, were the Arabs and the Jews being purged from Christianity. And I would like to talk about, I think, something which is mentioned in passing several times. It's in the book, no reason why it should be elaborated, and that's the relationship between Marx and Keynes, because I consider myself influenced by both. One, the greatest economist of the 19th century, the other, greatest economist of the 20th century. Actually, Keynes was born just 6 months before Marx died, though there's no evidence that they ever met. What do they have in common? I would say there are three important things and then a major difference, which will allow me to, and I'll wrap up on that major difference, which will lead me back to the book at hand. First, they're both demand-constrained systems. Right? They're both systems which are driven by demand, and in particular by what Keynesians would call an investment demand, what Marxists would call the advance of capital, though Keynes would have called that too, probably. Second, money is endogenous in both systems for different reasons. Marx, I believe, because my interpretation of Marx's treating money as endogenous is that he had based it on he thought it was commodity based with an intervention of the state, commodity money, in other words. There's some differences among the Keynesians as to how to explain the endogeneity of money. And third, that for want of a better word, Caldorian type of growth process, which is driven by profits or the surplus value, which is retained as profits. So those are the similarities, and I think that there are important insights for Keynesians to obtain from Marx and for Marxists to obtain from Keynesians. Particularly, I think that the Marxian analysis is weak on the short run, and the Keynesian analysis is weak on what I will now come to, and that is what term I despise, micro foundations. It seems to me, when I said the Keynesian tradition is macroeconomics. I could also have said, I should have said Marx too, but what I mean by that is that a macroeconomics is a discipline that recognizes that the parts devolve from the sum. That is, the parts do not add to the whole, the other way around. So how do you explain the parts? I think the way Marx did that is through the difference between the twofold nature of commodities. They have use, value in use, and they have value in exchange. Actually, because I don't have much time, I won't pursue that. Actually, Keynes also recognized that, though he didn't pursue it. He recognized it and discussed it in a spectacularly overlooked section in the general theory called An Appendix on User Cost, where he says If you ask someone in the street what they mean by the price of coal, they'll tell you they'll say the wages, the transport costs, the machinery costs, the electricity used, and so on. If you ask an economist what you mean by the price of coal, they'll say wages plus profit. That is a very deep point, if you think about it. And in saying that, Keynes was saying the difference between value in use and value in exchange. I'll just finish up by saying I think that it's there that the micro foundations come from some view of the what determines the total value of what is produced in a demand-constrained system. I want to congratulate you and your co-editor on putting together an excellent book. I hope it is used widely. I fear it will not be.
Thank you very much, John, and thank you for keeping to time. That's great. So I'd now like to call on Simon Mohan to give his view.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me. I enjoyed reading this book, and I think it's an important book. Obviously, like almost everybody else, I thought some chapters were better than others, and that's a matter of personal taste, really. But I do think it's an important book, and it deserves a wide readership. I'm going to be a little bit more critical than that, just to try to provoke discussion. But so I want to say at the outset that I like the book, and the criticisms that I want to talk about are essentially provoked by the book, and that seems to me to be a good thing. So everyone who's spoken has talked a little bit about what the book is about, the centrality of the principle of effective demand, that it's aggregate demand that determines output and employment, that the economy is demand-led both in the short run and the long run, that investment determines saving, that economies have to be considered as monetized economies. Now, all of that, I think, is really important and is well taken as a foundation for pretty much all the essays in the book. There are two other claims that are regarded, I think, as foundational claims that I think are a little bit weaker. One is that institutions make a difference. Now, in one sense, yes, that's obviously true. And this really relates to a point Vicky made, which is that I didn't find in the book enough differentiation of the positions taken in the book from the positions taken in other traditions of theorising, particularly the mainstream. So, for example, if one thinks about institutions, the mainstream has a fairly substantial analysis now of institutions in terms of partly transactions costs and partly embedded in a sort of principal-agent framework where it looks at essentially incentive compatibility conditions and with asymmetric information. So issues like moral hazard and adverse selection are to the fore. Now, one might not like this literature, but it is very substantial. And this book doesn't, in its focus on institutions, I didn't think this book really devoted much attention to establishing sort of a critical dividing lines between that neoclassical literature on the one hand and the way in which this book sees institutions as important on the other hand. And I think that's a shame, because if you're a postgraduate student, you're not only exposed to post-Keynesianism, you're probably mostly trained in the neoclassical tradition. And therefore, this stuff becomes second nature, and you want to know, well, what does the post-Keynesian tradition have to say in these terms? And this book doesn't really have much of a focus in that sense, and that, I think, is a bit of a pity. Another foundational statement is to do with the irreversibility of time, the idea that there is fundamental uncertainty, that the long run is basically the result of a series of short-run positions, that time is historical, that you have path dependence, hysteresis, and so on. And this is occasionally contrasted with the idea of infinitely forward-looking optimizers with rational expectations, and you know, that position is rightly of little interest in this book. But the notion of fundamental uncertainty does carry with it a sort of nihilism that the book escapes from. And the way it escapes from it is to reduce this notion of fundamental uncertainty to basically a statement that agents' expectations are adaptive. And that seems to me to really, the notion of fundamental uncertainty seems to be to be more than that, and merely to just say, well, the way in which we deal with this is we have adaptive expectations doesn't seem to me to do justice to the original insights of Keynes, I suppose. There's another issue about time, which is the assertion that analysis needs to be embedded in historical time. And I think that is absolutely right. But at the same time, if one looks at the sort of the formal models in the book, it's very difficult to find any sense of history in them at all. I mean, they don't do that. And that, I think, is a weakness in the sense that the basic idea is correct. Time, path dependence, historical time, all that is really important. But when it comes down to the formal models, it sort of seems to go away. And I think if I were a student, I'd be a little bit worried about that. The other thing I want to say about the lack of definition with regard to alternative traditions, going back to something Vicky said, which I think is a pity, is, although I accept there are long lead times in publishing, so perhaps this is ambitious. If one looks in the world today and says, OK, if I'm a sort of postgraduate macroeconomist and I'm surfing the web, basically, where are the most exciting things being written every day? And it's probably, you'd have to say, I ought to read Paul Krugman's blog and I ought to read Brad DeLong's blog. And then I would sort of realise, well, Krugman and DeLong, what are they banging on about all the time? They're banging on about the need to return to Hicks's ISLM analysis, the need for conventional economics to return to that, and in particular, to return to the notion of liquidity trap. But I couldn't find anything about liquidity traps in this book at all. And yet for the sort of the Keynesians hyphen not post-Keynesians, the Krugmans, the Brad DeLongs of this world, and to some extent Christina Romer, and to some extent even Larry Summers, the liquidity trap is one of the most important concepts, in fact. And they will all throw their hands up and say, yeah, I know we didn't think this in the 80s and the 90s, but we were wrong. And they, you know, they're perfectly straightforward about it. But this book doesn't really engage with that. Now, obviously, you know, the papers were sent to the publishers, what, a year ago or whenever it was, so perhaps I'm asking for the moon. But if I were a postgraduate student, again, I'd be a little bit concerned about this. You know, here are these very famous macroeconomists talking about the necessity of returning to Hicks's 37, 38 article, whenever it is, and the real importance of the liquidity trap with historical references to Japan thrown in and so on. And what do I think? And so I'm left a little bit up in the air. Okay, that's part. Let me make, how much longer? Let me make three other points. Have I got time for that? First point is about investment. The idea seems to be that planned investment in the post-Keynesian tradition is, particularly the Kaletskian version that Engelbert talked about, is a function of capacity utilization. And capacity utilization is taken as the measure of the buoyancy of current aggregate demand. And then that affects expectations of future demand. And prices are a markup over costs, with the degree of markup determined by competition. Now, that's straightforward in one sense. But I can sort of ask myself, is that, what's happened to animal spirits here? Where have they gone? Where have they gone? They seem to have sort of disappeared. And so that's one issue. And then the second issue is to do with the underlying nature of competition. Now, this is with my sort of Marxist hat on, really, I would say, I suppose. Whereas I tend to think of competition between firms as not being structured by perfect competition or oligopoly or monopoly or whatever, but rather by the idea that the way you increase labour productivity is through investment. And it's only through productivity increases that you're going to survive in the war of competition. And consequently, there is a sense in which you are forced to invest, because if you don't invest, you will die. And that idea is true, whatever the state of capacity utilisation. But there's nothing much about that in the book, and I would have liked perhaps a little bit more of that. So that's the first point. The second point I want to make, I said 3 points tonight. The second point was about the nature of macroeconomic aggregates, and in particular the word class, which is used quite a lot in post-Keynesian economics. Now, Engelbert has already alluded to the sort of the lack of political economy, the lack of a grounded political economy of the state as an area where more work is needed. And I think that's right. But the notion of class basically reduces to workers receive wages, capitalists receive profits, they have different savings propensities out of that, and this enables a conflict theory of inflation. Mostly inspired, I would guess, by the stagflation of the 1970s. However, one could question whether this sort of conflict is the right one to be looking at all. You could easily argue that the 1970s conflicts were essentially, and perhaps this is clearer in retrospect, a conflict within the capitalist class between those who were, say, industrialists or managers or representatives of national capital, in a sense, who wanted a loose monetary policy with low interest rates to accommodate higher levels of aggregate demand, versus those with a more international orientation, a finance orientation, who wanted a much more restrictive monetary policy, much higher interest rates, much more unemployment, and so on. And that's clearly a different way of looking at it, but those divisions, those types of divisions, don't get much of a look in the post-Keynesian notion of class, which is a little bit undifferentiated. It also has very little bearing, the way post-Keynesians use it, on the growth of class inequalities. And that's basically because the notion of wages is too inclusive. The way to think about that is just to recognise, well, let's think of Bill Gates, and let's think of Bill Gates' office cleaner. They both receive wages, so they both have the same savings propensities out of those wages, which are different from the savings propensities out of profits. And you sort of think, huh, is this what class is really about? So there seems to me, I think, a little bit of a weakness there. And finally, the last point I want to make is to ask the question, and again, this is I'm trying to think of this as, what would a postgraduate student think? Why do neoclassical economists think the way that they do?
That's the biggest mystery of all.
And it seems to me that an adequate social theory has to do three things. Obviously, it has to account for the various propositions that constitute its core. Okay, that's what a theory is. It also, though, has to give you some idea of why wrong theories are wrong. Okay, well, post-Keynesians certainly do that about various bits of neoclassical economics, and that's fine. But it also, I think, has to give you some clue as to why wrong theories arise and why they last. And I think for post-Keynesian economists, this is just a mystery. And I think in that sense, the Marxist tradition has more to offer. But then I would say that, wouldn't I? Thanks.
Thank you very much. Demand regimes, because that is important to a lot of authors in that book. And we probably should do more on personal and functional income distributions. Indeed, several of the authors in there have done either empirical or theoretical work on the issue. So, I mean, there's work out there, and it's important, and what should include that more prominently. With Simon's comments, I think there's 3 points where I agree rather straightforward. That is a lack of discussion of neoclassical analysis of institutions, a lack of living up to coming up with a concrete analysis of the role of animal spirits in determining investment, and delivering a historically embedded analysis. I think these are actual weaknesses of post-Keynesian economics. So there's an unfortunate but good reason why it's not in there, because I think that is underdeveloped. I have actually recently done empirical work on uncertainty and investment, and I found, I think, overall 3 empirical papers in the Journal of Post-Keynesian Economics on that issue. I mean, given how prominent it is in theory, there's a very clear lack of any empirical analysis on the issue. I'm less convinced by the second comment of Simon, that is on the analysis of class in post-Keynesian economics, where he was very quick to argue that we don't have industrial versus financial capital, if I can call it that way, in the analysis. It might be too little of it in a book. I think post-Keynesian economics usually has quite a lot of emphasis on, certainly the group of authors in that book, on basically industrial capital versus rentiers. And rentiers are, again, usually defined by income, by their income, type of income, which is interest and dividend income. And Eckhart, as well as myself, as well as Mark Lavoie and Tom Pelly have developed models that have these classes in there. Now, the stronger criticism about our notion of class that I would have expected from a Marxist like Simon didn't come, and that is that we don't have a notion of class rooted in the production process. And that is what Marxian economics has, whatever else its weaknesses might be. And I think that's a serious issue. We don't have an analysis of class in the sense of production process and exploitation, but we also don't have analysis of class in what Marxists would call the class for itself, in terms of how class consciousness is developed in struggles with other classes, what E.P. Thompson's and historians would have been big on. And that, I think, is a... If you think of how you turn a situation like the present crisis into a political momentum for Keynesian or progressive policies, is a big issue. That we're basically... equating classes with their income streams. For political mobilization, that's obviously not sufficient. Finally, on the ecological issue, that question fills me with a lot of pain. Now, you might be surprised to learn that I, as a matter of fact, started out as an ecological economist. My first publication in 97 was in ecological economics on the Index of Sustainable and Economic Welfare in Austria, case study of the ICEW for the country. But I basically afterwards moved completely away from it because I didn't quite see the connection. Now, from the post-Keynesian side, I'm more clear on why there's so little connection. First, post-Keynesians don't have much of analysis on the supply side. There's little analysis of production, other than that the supply side reacts endogenously, but it doesn't help you to design, say, a tax system that would minimize carbon dioxide emissions or anything, if it's all you know is that it's endogenous. The exception to that would be that the neo-Ricardians that are not very prominent in the post-Keynesian debates, actually there were several neo-Ricardians that had environmental economics papers, because as they're working with their input-output tables, they, for them it's basically a special case of joint production, which might or might not be a convincing story, but at least it is some story. So that could potentially hook up to what some ecological economists who are also working with input-output tables are doing. Now, but there's another deep-rooted problem in post-Keynesian economics, and that is that while neoclassical economists basically said, well, the ultimate aim of the economics is to deliver high levels of utility, Marxists would say that in a good world you get rid of exploitation. Post-Keynesians or Keynesians essentially say what we need is full employment, and how we get it is usually via higher growth. There's only footnotes about the reduction of working time, which might be the obvious meeting ground between post-Keynesians and ecological economics. But underlying the problem is, of course, that there's fairly little analysis of the quality of life or what it is that we are aiming for other than low levels of unemployment. And as I said, we've tried in the conference that we are organizing to get a dialogue started, but we are finding it very difficult. And so far we are also finding it difficult to get much interest on part of ecological economists. But I'm very happy to discuss that further afterwards, in particular with respect to our conference.
Thank you. That's great. Well, I think that was an excellent response to all those many points. I'm sure you've made notes by the sheaf, and of course you'll be able to listen to it on the machine when you when you get back.